Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day. Duterte made another rape joke, but Filipinos really get him, an aide says. By Joseph Hinks. A spokesman for Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has justified a rape joke the president made on the grounds that the majority of the people, especially the masses, really get him. Presidential spokesperson Ernesto Abella came to Duterte's defense at a press briefing Monday, Philippine news site Rappler reports, after the latter was criticized for remarks he made on Friday suggesting that some rapists were worthy of congratulations. "What I don't like are kids being raped," Duterte reportedly said during a speech in his Davao City home Friday. "You can mess with, maybe, Miss Universe. Maybe I will even congratulate you for having the balls to rape somebody when you know you are going to die." The Philippines hosted the Miss Universe beauty pageant in January this year. Rumors Duterte would judge the pageant flared in the local press before its organizers said having government judges contravened official policy. Addressing the latest controversy Monday, Abella told reporters, "There are those who tend to zero in on certain details, but as far as the public is concerned, and they are the ones who really approve of him, they find the president is somebody who understands them, who has their common interests, their common good at heart." Duterte's Miss Universe comments are just the most recent of a bizarre series of jokes about rape. In May, soon after ISIS-pledged militias overran the southern city of Marawi, the president urged soldiers to continue working, saying he would back them even if they each raped three women. And on the campaign trail last year, Duterte talked about the rape murder of an Australian missionary during a 1980s Davao City prison riot, saying that he, as mayor of Davao at the time, should have been first. President Trump just said this poll was the most inaccurate around the election. It wasn't. By Alana Abramson. President Trump questioned the accuracy of a new poll that shows him having the lowest approval rating of any modern president during the first 6 months of his term. He tweeted, "The ABC Washington Post poll, even though almost 40% is not bad at this time, was just about the most inaccurate poll around election time." But Trump's Sunday tweet about the accuracy of the ABC News Washington Post poll is questionable when the data is actually examined. The same poll showed Hillary Clinton narrowly leading Donald Trump 47% to 43% on November 7, 2016, one day before the election. It was a national poll that was assessing the overall popular vote, not the victory margins in individual states. And although Clinton lost the electoral vote, she did ultimately win the popular vote, 48.2% to 46.1%. That means the poll was 1 point off for Clinton and 3 points off for Trump, slightly outside of the poll's 2.5 margin of error for the latter, but only by a half a point. Other polls had similar results. The NBC WSJ poll released on November 6, 2016, also had Clinton leading Trump by 4 points, 44% to 40%. The final results fell outside the poll's 2.73 margin of error on both sides. The final pre-election poll conducted by CBS News New York Times, released on November 3, 2016, like the others, had Clinton leading Trump among likely voters 45 to 42%. In fact, out of the 21 general election polls showcased by the Real Clear Politics website on November 7, only two, the LA Times USC tracking poll and the IBD TIPP tracking poll, had Trump winning the general election. The state polls listed on that website were more inaccurate, with several incorrectly predicting, for example, that Clinton would win states like Florida, Michigan, and New Hampshire. The ABC News Washington Post poll also detected a loss in voter enthusiasm for Clinton following then-FBI Director James Comey's decision to reopen the probe into her emails in mid-October, a factor Clinton has said contributed to her loss. The change in strong enthusiasm for Clinton is not statistically significant and could reflect night-to-night variability. Still, it bears watching, the poll analysis stated on October 31st. Overall, the ABC News Washington Post poll certainly did not predict Trump's victory, but it also was more correct than the president led on in his tweet about assessing the ultimate outcome of the popular vote. The tweet was one of several Trump sent Sunday. Another, with all of its phony unnamed sources and highly slanted and even fraudulent reporting, hashtag fake news is distorting democracy in our country. Hillary Clinton can illegally get the questions to the debate and delete 33,000 emails, but my son Don is being scorned by the fake news media? How Strength Training Changes Your Body for Good, by Mandy Oaklander. The following story is excerpted from Time's special edition, The Science of Exercise, which is available at Amazon. Dr. Dina Oaklander, a psychiatry resident who also happens to be my sister, is the last person you'd ever expect to become a bodybuilder. She's naturally scrawny and a little bit shy, not the type of person to beast out at the gym, or so I once thought. In medical school, she'd counsel patients on the importance of exercise and feel like a hypocrite, she says, since she did little but shuttle from home to the hospital, spending her rare free time catching up on sleep. My body didn't feel good, and my mind didn't feel very good either, she says. But once she started taking her own advice as a resident at Loyola University Medical Center, Dina quickly became a hardcore strength training fanatic. Within a month of learning how to lift weights, she noticed she had more energy without needing as much sleep, she felt far less stressed out, and she saw her body tone up fast. Strength training is the only way you're going to truly be able to sculpt the physique of your personal dreams, says Sue Clark, a Chicago-based strength coach who trains Dina. Above and beyond the physical changes, though, a whole new persona emerges as people start to feel really confident in their own bodies. Clark saw the transformation in Dina just as she has in so many others. Once I can get someone on board with strength training, they're good for life because they're seeing results like they've never seen on cardio. The average American flat out loathes strength training. While about half of people do the recommended amount of aerobic activity each week, only 20% also do the muscle strengthening moves that work major muscle groups. Yet the scientific benefits are stacking up in favor of it, from bone protection to disease prevention, and it appears to have special benefits for women. There are so many misconceptions about strength and resistance training, says Larry Tucker, a professor in exercise sciences at Brigham Young University. One is that you'll become muscle-bound, so bulked up that your body becomes rigid. That myth was somewhat dispelled when athletes who started strength training saw that they could hit a ball farther, jump higher, and run faster, Tucker says. Gradually, we started realizing there are benefits beyond sports. But women in particular are neglecting strength training at their own peril. It's the only kind of exercise that makes muscles bigger, which lets them generate more strength and force faster. Muscle mass allows us to move, Tucker says. Young people tend to take for granted the day-to-day parts of life that require strength, like walking upstairs or picking up a baby. But a sedentary lifestyle means that people are gradually becoming weaker over time, he says. Building muscle can fight back against that process. It's also one of the very few ways to make bones denser, a perk that is especially important for women. Lifting something heavy, like a dumbbell, makes bones bear more weight, and in exercise, stressing your bones is a good thing, to a point, of course. Bones are constantly remodeling, explains Anthony Hackney, an exercise physiologist at the University of North Carolina. Your body is always adding calcium to your bones and taking calcium away from your bones, he says. This delicate balance starts to tip as people age, and they lose more mineral from the bone than they're able to lay down, Hackney says. Over time, bone gets less dense and more brittle and prone to osteoporosis, a condition that affects about 10 million Americans, 80% of whom are female. Women have smaller, thinner bones than men from the start, and after menopause, they lose estrogen, a hormone that protects bones. Strength training also comes with a less visible benefit of lowering risk for several diseases. The only real way we can increase our metabolism, unless we take drugs, is to lift weights and maintain or increase our lean mass, says Tucker. Doing so makes the body more sensitive to insulin and therefore more durable against certain diseases. Recent research suggests that strength training may lower a woman's risk for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. In a 2016 study, researchers from Harvard Medical School and the National Institutes of Health used data from nearly 36,000 older women who ranged in age from 47 to 98. The women filled out questionnaires for about a decade detailing their health and exercise levels, and one question asked women to estimate how much weightlifting or strength training they'd done per week in the past year. The researchers then tracked which of the women had a heart attack or stroke and which developed type 2 diabetes. Whether or not a woman did muscle-strengthening exercises indicated a lot about her health. Compared with women who avoided it, those who did any amount of strength training were more likely to have a lower body mass index and a healthier diet and less likely to be a current smoker. They also had a type 2 diabetes risk that was 30% lower and a cardiovascular disease risk 17% lower than those who did no strength training, even after researchers controlled for other variables like age, diet, and physical activity. Adding aerobic exercise helped drive both risks down even more. Those who did at least 120 minutes a week of aerobic exercise and some strength training had a type 2 diabetes risk 65% lower than women who didn't do either. Most people should do both kinds of exercises for the biggest gains, but if you had to choose one, Clark advises, pick strength training. Cardio is more digestible, it's less intimidating, but people also get less and less out of it over time, she says. As you grow fitter, you have to do more and more aerobic exercise to see the gains, she explains. Strength training, in her view, is the most efficient exercise for those with limited time. Powerlifting isn't the only way to get results. Strength training comes in far more accessible forms as well, many of which do not even require a gym membership and certainly don't require a personal trainer. Resistance bands, cheap strings of elastic that loop around arms or legs, are one good way to build strength without weights, for instance. A 2017 study showed that when frail women over 60 who were obese worked out with resistance bands for 3 months, they dropped body fat and increased bone density. Another option that involves even less equipment is to use your own body weight. Sitting up and down in a chair many times builds strength, as does jumping, which uses many of the leg's major muscles. Even walking can count as strength training, depending on the intensity. The right type and amount will be different for every woman, and man for that matter, but a little bit every day will do wonders. Just ask Dina, who's planning to enter her first bodybuilding competition a year after picking up her first weight. Not only do I look better than when I first started, but I also feel really confident, she says. Strength training opens up your thoughts for more positive thinking. Dina still urges her patients to exercise, but these days it's a prescription she really believes. Not everyone will become a bodybuilder, but most can get stronger and feel better by moving just a little bit more. I find myself really encouraging patients to turn to exercise as an outlet or a way to help them cope with some of the difficult things they're dealing with in life, she says. The message is different now because I do it myself.
A Female Doctor Who? It's About Timey-Wimey by Melissa Locker. The Doctor has been on the air since 1963. He has traveled the universe from Gallifrey to Earth and nearly everywhere in between. Thanks to his regenerative powers, the Time Lord has worn 12 different faces over the course of his estimated 2,000 years gallivanting across the universe. But one thing he has never regenerated as is a woman. Until now. The BBC just announced that the 13th Doctor will be played by Jodie Whittaker, an actress best known for her work in the British crime drama Broadchurch, where, perhaps tellingly, she played opposite David Tennant, who was Doctor Who's 10th Doctor. For many fans, when it comes to a female Doctor, it's about timey-wimey. Whittaker will succeed Peter Capaldi, who took the role in 2013 amid a bit of an outcry from fans who have long been awaiting the Doctor to regenerate as a woman or a person of color. After all, if the doctor has the power to regenerate in the first place, why would he only regenerate as a white male who speaks with a British or Scottish accent? Showrunner Steve Moffat was having none of it, though, because he only had eyes for Capaldi and didn't want to even consider anyone else, male or female. Back in 2015, he told Salon that he simply wanted to cast whoever would work best in the role, which he saw as the white male Capaldi, but claimed at the time that he was open to other iterations at the Doctor in the future. He also cast Pearl Mackey as Bill, a black gay character that played the Doctor's new companion. While fans have slowly warmed up to Capaldi, he is leaving the long-running series during this year's Christmas special and will hand over the keys to the TARDIS, his police box time machine, to Whittaker, who will suddenly be at the center of one of the most famous sci-fi shows in television history. "It's more than an honor to play the Doctor," Whittaker told BBC. "It means remembering everyone I used to be while stepping forward to embrace everything the Doctor stands for. Hope. I can't wait." The news, which was announced in a trailer after the Wimbledon's men's singles final, is particularly surprising to fans because the British press reported that the BBC had currently no plans for a female Doctor. Instead, the press was batting around names like Chris Marshall, Love Actually, and Tom Rosenthal, plebs, both white men, as well as David Harwood, who played David Estes on Homeland, and who, as a black man, would have been a change from the Doctor's long history. But it turns out that was a bit of a ruse, though, as Chris Chibnall, the show's new head writer and executive producer who is taking over the reins from David Moffat, apparently always wanted the new Doctor to be a woman. "I always knew I wanted the 13th Doctor to be a woman," he said in a press release, calling Whittaker the show's number one choice. "Her audition for the Doctor simply blew us away. Jodie is an in-demand, funny, inspiring, super-smart force of nature and will bring loads of wit, strength, and warmth to the role. The 13th Doctor is on her way." Capaldi is happy to hand his sonic screwdriver over to Whittaker, too. "Anyone who has seen Jodie Whittaker's work will know that she is a wonderful actress of great individuality and charm. She has, above all, the huge heart to play this most special part. She's going to be a fantastic Doctor," he said. The fact that the Doctor is now a woman raises all sorts of exciting questions, like will she have a male companion who randomly wears skimpy clothing? Will she be a lesbian and have a strangely intimate will-they-or-won't-they relationship with Bill? Can the Doctor get pregnant, or will she simply continue to answer the universe's distress calls, solving whatever problem is thrown her way with simply her wits and a sonic screwdriver? For many fans, it's an exciting change that will make the show even more relatable, as much as one can relate to an ancient time-traveling Good Samaritan. However, there will undoubtedly be some complaints from fans who can only envision the Doctor as a white male with a British accent. As the Doctor himself might say, "The universe is big. It's vast and complicated and ridiculous. And sometimes, very rarely, impossible things just happen and we call them miracles." In that context, it's not all that surprising that the Doctor would regenerate as a woman, particularly when his regenerative powers just might nearly be used up, as hinted in past episodes. Just call it a miracle that the Doctor can still regenerate at all. In other words, as the Doctor said way back in the beginning, "This is who I am, right here, right now, all right? All that counts is here and now, and this is me."
Healthcare vote postponed while Senator John McCain recovers from eye surgery. From the Associated Press in Washington. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Saturday he will delay consideration of health care legislation in the Senate after Senator John McCain's announced absence following surgery left Republicans short of votes on their marquee legislation. McConnell's announcement amounted to another setback for GOP efforts promoted by President Donald Trump to repeal and replace Obamacare after years of promises. McConnell issued his statement not long after McCain's office disclosed that he had undergone surgery to remove a blood clot from above his left eye and had been advised by his doctors to stay in Arizona next week to recover. With McConnell's health care legislation already hanging by a thread in the Senate with no votes to spare, McCain's absence meant it would become impossible for the majority leader to round up the votes needed to move forward with the bill next week as planned. "While John is recovering, the Senate will continue our work on legislative items and nominations and will defer consideration of the Better Care Act," said McConnell. He did not say when he would aim to return to the health care bill. Even before Saturday night's developments, the fate of the health care legislation looked deeply uncertain in the Senate. In addition to two announced GOP no votes from moderate Susan Collins of Maine and conservative Rand Paul of Kentucky, there were at least a half dozen other Republican senators who were withholding support from or expressing reservations about the bill McConnell released Thursday. Last month, McConnell had to cancel a vote on a previous version of the legislation as GOP opposition left its defeat assured. In a Senate divided 52-48 between Republicans and Democrats, McConnell can lose no more than two votes and still prevail. The Senate bill, like legislation passed earlier by the House, repeals mandates requiring individuals to carry insurance and businesses to offer it, and unravels an expansion of the Medicaid program for the poor and disabled enacted under President Barack Obama's law. Analyses of the earlier version of the Senate bill found it would result in more than 20 million additional uninsured Americans over a decade compared to the current law. The newest version attempts to attract conservative support by allowing insurers to offer skimpy plans alongside more robust ones, but also reaches out to moderates by adding billions in help for the opioid crisis and to defray high costs for consumers. With the votes set for the coming week now indefinitely postponed, GOP success in its long-promised Obamacare repeal grows all the more uncertain despite heavy lobbying in recent days by Trump administration officials. Democrats are unanimously opposed, as are the nation's major medical groups and insurers. In Phoenix, Mayo Clinic hospital doctors said McCain underwent a minimally invasive procedure to remove the nearly 2-inch clot and that the surgery went very well, a hospital statement said. McCain was reported to be resting comfortably at his home in Arizona. Pathology reports on the clot were expected in the next several days. McCain, 80, is a 3-time survivor of melanoma. Records of his medical exams released in 2008 when he was the GOP candidate for president show that he has had precancerous skin lesions removed and had an early-stage squamous cell carcinoma, an easily cured skin cancer, removed. He was reelected in November to a 6th Senate term. Most macaroni and cheese products contain these chemicals, study finds, by Kate Samuelson. A new study finds that most mac and cheese products contain phthalates, chemicals that make plastics more flexible and are found in things like shampoo, fast food, and cosmetics. The highest concentrations of phthalates were found in the packets of cheese powder. The Coalition for Safer Food Processing and Packaging study, which was detailed in the New York Times, found that the chemicals were found in 29 of 30 samples of macaroni and cheese products tested, including organic products. While phthalates are not added to food, they may slip in through processing. Past research has linked phthalates to health issues, including hormone disruption and lower sperm count. The Coalition has launched a hashtag Cleanup Kraft petition to encourage Kraft, which makes the most mac and cheese products sold, to eliminate potentially troublesome chemicals in its cheese products. In an open letter to the Kraft Heinz Company, representatives from the Coalition have asked the company to eliminate the toxic industrial chemicals from their products. For pregnant women and young children, who are the most vulnerable groups, food is often the number one source of phthalates exposure, the letter says. And fatty foods, including dairy products, tend to be the greatest contributor of dietary exposure to phthalates. In a statement released to Time, a spokesperson for the Kraft Heinz Company said that phthalates are not added to its products, and the trace amounts that were reported in this limited study are more than 1,000 times lower than levels that scientific authorities have identified as acceptable. Our products are safe for consumers to enjoy, the company said. How U.S. conservatives have changed the fight for Charlie Gard's future. By Kate Samuelson in London. Trump, the Pope, they all have hope, read the message printed on the back of the T-shirt of a protester outside London's Royal Courts of Justice on July 13th. Only about a dozen demonstrators were present, but people across the world had their eyes on the outcome of the hearing taking place within the London court. The case of Charlie Gard, a brain-damaged British infant on life support due to a rare mitochondrial disease, has pitted a children's hospital against parents in a legal battle over what is in the best interests of the child. Charlie's parents opposed his doctor's preference to move the baby to a palliative care regime and take him off life support. They wanted to take the 11-month-old to America for experimental nucleoside treatment, a trip they had raised more than £1.3 million to pay for via crowdfunding sites. The decision went to Britain's High Court and eventually to the European Court of Human Rights. The ECHR agreed with the domestic court's ruling in favor of the hospital, who argued that the experimental treatment won't end the child's suffering and that Charlie should be allowed to die with dignity. But despite the EU court declaring its June 27th decision as final, a judge allowed a new hearing to take place July 13th in light of new evidence showing that the untested therapy could be effective. On Thursday, the UK's High Court heard that a US neurology professor, who cannot be named for legal reasons, contacted Great Ormond Street Hospital after speaking to the White House to offer new evidence that the trial treatment would be more successful than previously thought. The case was ongoing on Friday. The twist in the legal case comes as a movement to bring Charlie to the U.S. has become an international campaign, bolstered by the involvement of conservative groups from the United States led by Catholics and evangelicals. Major attention on the case first picked up outside the U.K. when Pope Francis said in a Vatican statement that he was following the case with affection and sadness and prayed that Charlie's parents wish to accompany and treat their child until the end isn't neglected. The following day, President Donald Trump tweeted to his 33.7 million followers that he would be delighted to help Charlie, and the saga reached an entirely new audience. Suddenly, the case of Charlie Gard was being discussed in churches and by socially conservative groups across the U.S. On July 6th, the Susan B. Anthony List, March for Life, Concerned Women of America, and Americans United for Life, all socially conservative groups active in opposition to abortion, held a joint press conference in Washington, D.C., where they announced the launch of a campaign to save Charlie Gard, including a petition and a social media push to raise awareness and support for Charlie and his parents. Who do we think we are to decide who gets to live and who doesn't, whose life is valuable and whose is not? Penny Nance, CEO and president of Concerned Women for America, told attendees during the event. This is way above our pay grade. This is a matter for God. To underscore the point, some churches and conservative groups have sent individuals to Britain to lend Charlie's family support. One day after the July 6th press conference, Catherine Glenn Foster, president of Americans United for Life, arrived in London to provide legal counsel for the Gard family in their ongoing court case. That same week, Reverend Patrick Mahoney, a well-known U.S. evangelist who was once jailed for defying a court order that prevented him from demonstrating outside abortion clinics in Texas, flew to the U.K. to pray at Charlie's bedside. The efforts also continued back in the U.S. After the New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Irving Medical Center offered to admit and evaluate Charlie if emergency approval was received from the FDA, two Republican congressmen proposed giving Charlie American citizenship. The politicians Brad Wenstrup and Trent Frank said in a joint statement that they hoped to make Charlie a lawful permanent resident of the U.S. in order for him to receive treatment his Great Ormond Street Hospital doctors described in a statement as futile, meaning it would be pointless or of no effective benefit. It's interesting to consider why a tiny baby an ocean away has captured the imagination of the United States, said Marjorie Dansfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, in a phone interview with Time. I think it's something fundamental that has really touched a chord. You don't have to be an ethics professor or a legal scholar to understand that an institution is not a parent, and they are the only ones who will truly make the decisions that are in a child's best interest. Dannenfelser first learned the details of the Charlie Gard case during a meeting in the White House with Vice President Mike Pence. The Vice President's office confirmed to Time that Pence has been following the developments of the case closely, although he has not raised it through diplomatic channels. "We got into this conversation and Pence was very emotional about it," Dannenfelser said. "The more we discussed it, the more we knew we had to do something about it." The following morning, she communicated the Save Charlie Gard message to her organization, which has nearly 500,000 members, and banded together with other heads of similar U.S. groups opposed to abortion to hold the press conference. "The hope is that the Gard parents will be allowed to care for Charlie in the way they want to," she told Time. "I don't know if our work will have an effect on the judge, but I do know that sometimes when people make decisions, they don't realize they've touched a nerve. And I think this judge and this hospital will now understand they have touched a deep nerve and that the whole world is watching. And when you think the whole world is watching, you're very careful with your decision-making." Upon learning of the judge's decision to hold the July 13th hearing, Pastor Mahoney implied in a Facebook post that his prayers had been answered, writing, "While I was praying in front of the hospital, an incredible statement came from them that they are having a court hearing on new information regarding Charlie's case." That same day, the Gard family's former spokeswoman expressed her fears in a Guardian interview that Mahoney was using the vulnerable family situation to further his own political and religious crusade. "Mahoney appears to be seizing on their case to make the most of it," she said. Religious figures in the UK have also voiced concerns about the involvement of outside groups. Thomas Williams, an auxiliary bishop for the British city of Liverpool, questioned the motives of some external actors. "It's a terrible situation for both the family and the hospital," he told Time. "I've always accepted, as a priest and a hospital chaplain, that people need to be allowed to die, and sometimes nature needs to take its course. The right-wing element of these evangelicals, I'm afraid I'm not down that line at all. I can't read their minds, but I do think that people will stand on soapboxes when situations arise." Physicians have noted that medically, the experimental therapy isn't a cure and has only a small chance of stopping Charlie's condition from getting worse. Time reached out to Great Ormond Street Hospital for comment on the treatment, but was unsuccessful. "This kind of intervention is very unusual in the UK," said Professor Nina Modi, president of the UK's Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. Although she did not want to comment specifically about the Charlie Gard case, she told Time external groups rarely attempt to intervene in such an overt way. "It comes as a great surprise to me to see these interventions being made," she said. "First and foremost, you would think these organizations and individuals would understand that they are not privy to all of the details due to patient confidentiality. So how can they be commenting in the full light of all knowledge?" Nevertheless, the campaign by social conservatives from the U.S. has undoubtedly had a major impact on the case. The fresh evidence presented in Thursday's hearings might not have emerged had it not been for the involvement of the White House, and Charlie's family believes the campaign may have saved their child's life. Gawain Towler, who was recently hired as the Gard family's publicist, told Time that he thought the July 13th hearing would not have happened without foreign supporters piling on the pressure. "The judge has said he won't be affected by social media, but this is common law and public opinion matters in common law," he added. "To ignore public opinion is counter to everything our legal system stands for." With reporting by Zeke J. Miller in Washington. The 7 most influential coffee roasters in America. From Starbucks to Stumptown, these companies brought roasting to a new level. By John Sherman. Coffee roasters occupy a hazy, just out of focus place in popular American food culture. Even those well known enough to be recognized by name or logo are often more associated with the cafes they operate than their roasting practices. As a result, their influence in the coffee scene depends on the geographic availability of their product. As with craft beer, regional delicacies remain, but a few have gone national. Independent coffee roasting in the U.S. began in the mid-1960s in California and gained momentum in the 1980s. High coffee culture in America is now most closely associated with coastal cities like Seattle, San Francisco, and New York City, but many serious roasters are located a bit more out of the way. We now live in the so-called third wave of coffee. The first wave saw the industrialization of coffee, from pre-ground beans in vacuum packs and instant coffee crystals. The second wave involved the proliferation of big-box coffee chains with expensive taste, like Starbucks, Caribou, and It's a Grind. Third-wave coffee can be seen as a reaction to the commercialized lowest common denominator of Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts, focusing attention on both a more refined product and more ethical coffee sourcing. Each major third-wave coffee roaster lays claim to inventing, inspiring, or establishing some major tenet of contemporary high-end coffee consumption in the U.S., which becomes difficult to tease apart in hindsight. The field is now crowded with established, inspiring inventors. What can be said is that each of these roasters made some definitive contribution to the field and have remained influential on the contemporary American coffee scene. We start with Pete's Coffee and Tea, San Francisco, California, 1966, introduced roasted coffee to the U.S. The earliest coffee roasting pioneer in America was, perhaps unsurprisingly, an immigrant, Alfred Peet, later of Peet's Coffee and Tea. Born into a coffee roasting family in the Netherlands in 1920, Peet opened a coffee roastery and cafe in Berkeley, California in 1966. Peet's was the original inspiration for Starbucks founders Jerry Baldwin, Zeb Ziegel, and Gordon Bowker, who were exposed to Peet's during their time at the University of San Francisco. In 1984, the three Starbucks founders acquired Peet's. Starbucks, Seattle, Washington, 1971-1982, commercialized coffee roasting. Howard Schultz joined Starbucks in 1982 as director of marketing and, after a trip to Milan, tried to convince the company founders to serve brewed coffee alongside their retail business. Failing that, he left the company in 1985 and opened a chain called Il Giornale, modeled on an Italian coffee shop, down to standing counters and opera music. It's from this venture that Starbucks acquired its particular self-styled Italian-inspired lingo, grande and venti sizes, espresso as the basic unit of coffee rather than drip coffee. In 1987, Il Giornale bought Starbucks, took on its name, and began expanding rapidly. As of 2016, there were more than 14,000 Starbucks locations across the U.S. It may be commonplace, but the sheer size of Starbucks has, arguably, made room for many of the smaller roasters that have come after it. Intelligentsia, Chicago, Illinois, 1995, introduced direct trade. Though its first location was in Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood, the germ of Intelligentsia can be found in the Bay Area, where founders Doug Zell and Emily Mang were living before founding what is now a robust number of coffee bars in cities across the country. One major leap forward in Intelligentsia's approach, common to the big three, was partnering directly with coffee farmers, what company literature calls direct trade. Under normal capitalistic circumstances, direct trade would be sold as a corner cut to eliminate middleman profit sharers, a la Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's brands everything. In the big three coffee universe, direct trade is an Epicurean decision, a way to select coffee beans as discerningly as possible, and secondarily, a moral one, supporting growers directly rather than through distributors. Even its name, Intelligentsia, suggests the lifestyle of a growing coffee elite, urbane, sophisticated, single-origin, pour-over drinkers. Together, Intelligentsia, Starbucks, and Pete's Coffee and Tea make up the big three. Counterculture, Durham, North Carolina, 1995, Coffee Education. The first East Coast coffee epicenter, Counterculture is today one of the most visible roasters in the U.S. Founders Fred Hoke and Brett Smith began building their business with restaurant supply in mind, and their corporate history notes that the first bag of roasted coffee Counterculture sold was to a Durham restaurant called Pop's Trattoria. The company remains headquartered in Durham and has made coffee education a priority of its mission. In recent years, Counterculture has built 11 training centers across the U.S., from Asheville to L.A., with free weekly coffee tastings on Friday mornings, giving coffee drinkers equal opportunity for informed appreciation. Stumptown, Portland, Oregon, 1999, Green Team Sourcing. Another product of the Pacific Northwest, Stumptown has gone full Starbucks, now offering bottled cold brew in grocery stores across the country. Nevertheless, Stumptown has gone to great lengths in the service of direct trade, establishing what it calls its green team of coffee sourcers, who visit coffee growers year-round to hand-select coffee beans as thoroughly as possible. The company claims to pay producers up to 4 times the market price of their crop, allowing the green team to ask for more than simple farming, such as hand-picking each cherry at ideal ripeness or implementing a new piece of equipment. This explains the at times alarming price of direct trade Stumptown beans, $20 for 12 ounces of Columbia El Jordan, $23 for 12 ounces of Burundi Mapanga Karema from Eastern Africa, or the more attainable $15 for 12 ounces of Hairbender Blend. Stumptown isn't terribly far out of pace with other independent roasters with robust sourcing methodology. Intelligentsia offers 200 grams, around 7 ounces, of Finca Tequesi Bolivia Geisha Special Selection for $50. But the role of growers in the company's practices is notably foreground. La Colombe, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 1994, Broadbase Goodwill. Of the same generation of the Big Three, but with so far a narrower national reach, La Colombe Coffee Roasters was founded in Philadelphia by friends J.P. Ibera and Todd Carmichael, lately also of other coffee-related ventures, including the Haiti Coffee Academy, a Clinton Foundation-backed development program for coffee growers in Haiti. La Colombe may have been the earliest independent roaster to adopt a broad-based direct trade agreement with coffee growers, a model that continues to distinguish late second-wave, early third-wave U.S. coffee roasters. Blue Bottle, Oakland, California, early 2000s, Roast to Cup. Likely the tweeest coffee roaster in operation in the U.S. today, Blue Bottle is something of a darling. Blue Bottle is the house coffee of Alice Waters' famed Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Founder James Freeman began selling roasted beans at farmers markets in San Francisco in 2002 with a founding credo to sell beans roasted no longer than 48 hours prior. This strict timestamp, coupled with Blue Bottle's focus on single-origin coffees, speaks to a sense of purity that has come to typify third-wave coffee production, from bean terroir and provenance to brewing and roasting time, temperature, and method. Honorable mention. These roasters are influential in their own right, but aren't quite as heavy hitters as those listed above. Parlor Coffee, Brooklyn, Stumptown alum. Ruby Coffee Roasters, Nelsonville, Wisconsin, Intelligentsia alum. Orin's Daily Roast, Manhattan, only in Manhattan, 24-hour bean turnaround versus Blue Bottle's 48. Cafe Grumpy, New York City, most famous coffee roaster on TV. Tandem, Portland, coffee from the other Portland. Ritual, San Francisco, giving Blue Bottle a run for its twee money. PT's, Topeka, if you can believe it. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.